Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
From KQED in San Francisco and Public Radio International, it's Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. On today's show, who's whispering into the ears of the military generals in Burma? And recovering gamblers preach to those addicted to casino tables.
So I started to gamble just for fun, you know, play a little bit slot machine, but eventually I crossed the line.
Pacific Time, your passport to Asia and America. Welcome to Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. An envoy from the United Nations met with Burma's junta government this week to urge restraint in how it deals with protesters of the pro-democracy uprising. The same day the envoy left Burma, the military rounded up people in the middle of the night and took them away. Reports say hundreds and possibly thousands of monks and other demonstrators have been arrested. Burmese authorities acknowledged that 9 people were killed when military forces squashed pro-democracy demonstrations last week. Some groups inside the country say more than 100 were killed. The UN Secretary General said he plans to ask the Security Council to consider further action against Burma, which was renamed Myanmar by the military government. Burmese native Maung Zarni, who founded the Free Burma Coalition and now lives in Britain, has helped facilitate dialogue between the junta and Western governments. He says the opinion of Western countries doesn't carry much currency with Burma's military government.
Now, the United States, you know, has been like ratcheting up pressure, but it has been so far ineffectual. And part of the reasons, like, you know, that George Bush just snapped a visa ban. And the generals don't need to come here. They don't feel that they're safe. They don't feel they need to come to San Francisco to shop. You know, they can go to Singapore. They can go to Hong Kong. They get anything they want. So they don't, basically, essentially, this is a regime that is prepared not to engage with the West unless that engagement is on their own terms. And you know that in this interconnected age of nations, you cannot just simply like engage with the international community on your own terms. There's got to be like give and take. And this regime seems so inflexible that they want to be left alone.
You know, during the crackdown, the United Nations Security Council was discussing sanctions on Burma. And that was something that when you founded the Free Burma Coalition, you advocated isolating Burma as well as sanctions. And in fact, you got companies like Pepsi Cola and about 100 other multinational companies to leave, to withdraw business from Burma. But in 2004, your group made an about turn. What was that all about?
Well, you know, we were inspired by what the African National Congress activists and their supporters internationally did, which was like using divestment and consumer boycotts, international isolation as the main international support strategy. But at the that was in the early 1990s, and in those days, no one really took China or India for that matter seriously. Yeah, and so we failed to anticipate the rise of China and the rise of India and the implications for the Burmese domestic politics. Yeah. And now, like, you know, like looking back, with the benefit of the hindsight, we realized that was a cardinal mistake that we made. Yeah. And Burma is sandwiched between like China and India. We share over 1,000 miles borders with each country, and we are the linchpin or the largest land bridge between Middle East via Bangladesh, Afghanistan, and the entire Southeast Asia, major trading route, a major strategic area, alternative to the piracy-prone Strait of Malacca, where the largest oil flow, or one of the largest oil flows in the world, is taking place on a day-to-day basis. And so the geopolitical, geoeconomic situation that has bearing on the Burmese domestic politics favors the incumbent, So nobody wants to, you know, rock the boat in Burma because, you know, China, India, all the ASEAN countries, they want to be friends with, or they want to be on friendly terms with the Burmese junta, you know, for two reasons. One, it is a very, very strategic place for them, you know. And two, we have, like, you know, a sizable quantity of natural gas and oil. And both China and India, as well as Thailand, need a you know, massive amount of energy inflow. Import into their country, and Burma is one of the answers. And so in that situation, you know, like the West from say like you know 20,000 miles away has very very little leverage over the situation. And the West, you know, for Burma is not number one priority issue, not even top priority issue. It's a value issue. It's a humanitarian rights issue. But for China, India, and all the ASEAN countries, it is a strategic issue. So like they're prepared to defend Burma because it's defending their interests.
What do you think this means for the pro-democracy movement?
Well, it means that, you know, that people are committed or people need to be committed. You know, and that means that Burmese people and those outside who are inspired by what, you know, the Burmese people on the ground are having absolutely nothing, only armed only with idealism, you know, of freedom and democracy. Are doing, and we all need to be committed to, for the long haul. And this change is going to be like at least it's going to take at least a generation. But you know, like I don't feel powerless, although I'm only a citizen, you know, in the world. And I don't think Americans should feel powerless about it. This is a representative democracy. You know, you can always exert pressure. You know, this is an election year, and make sure that these politicians don't simply grandstand. Or like give this issue lip service.
So what would you advocate that the U.S. Congress do at this point?
Well, I think that the U.S. Congress should put or persuade the White House, you know, for this issue to be taken seriously, not just making media comments. You know, like George Bush and Laura Bush have been making, like, you know, very high-profile media comments, extremely critical of the regime, extremely supportive of the people, and those are welcome and they appreciate it. But they need to put it on the priority list and use, you know, U.S. influence to convene either an international conference on Burma or to, you know, start 5- or 6-party process bringing China, India, and all Burma's neighbors, as well as the junta and Burmese opposition, to help de-escalate the conflict and to help find ways for the Burmese to reconcile with each other.
Dr. Zarni is a visiting fellow at Oxford University. He'll be discussing Burma's political situation at Stanford University on October 18th. We've got a link on our website, kqed.org/Pacific Time. Japan is the 10th largest country in population, but it's second only to the United States when it comes to the size of its economy. Just to the west across the sea, China is the world's most populous nation, and its economy is on the move, growing at nearly 10% a year. Throughout the last century, when China and Japan weren't literally at war, they were still fierce rivals. But the global economy is changing the way the countries relate to each other and the world. Pacific Times correspondent Jocelyn Ford has lived in both Japan and China for the last 25 years. She reflects about the different ways the two countries present themselves on the world stage.
Beijing is in the midst of its 4th annual art fair. It's 3 weeks long, with something going on every day. At the event I went to, there were graffiti artists, painters, and this multicultural band with American and Uyghur musicians from China's far west. Near the band, I ran into a Japanese gallery owner. Mizuma Toshitaka told me he'd come to China to launch one of his artists on an international career. He came to Beijing, he said, because Western art buyers don't bother with Tokyo anymore. He said Japan missed its chance to become the art center for Asia. When it was in its economic heyday 20 years ago, Japan never grabbed the world's imagination like China has. I've lived in China for the last 7 years, and before that, 20 in Japan. The two countries could hardly be more different. If you could give countries a personality test based on the ancient Chinese philosophy of yin and yang, Japan would be the yin, the passive, dark pessimist. It's enchanted by subtleties and appreciates humility, self-deprecation. China is the yang. the outgoing, optimistic extrovert, in love with grandeur, bold colors, loud noises, and boastful posturing. And this theory, if you buy it, has implications for everything from the geopolitics to the economy to art sales. China, the Yang personality, has a long history of throwing its doors open to foreigners. You can still find communities descended from Arab merchants. They came to China well over 1,000 years ago, and back then, largely controlled trade. Today, China wants to learn fast how to be a global economic power again. So it encourages foreign companies to invest, provided they share their know-how. It's confident it can learn to compete with the world's best. Japan never welcomed foreigners in the same way. It was fearful that its own companies would be wiped out. China plows forward and embraces change with all its uncertainties. There's an optimism that something new will be something better. It has a historical memory of being the center of the world centuries ago. To Japan, change is scary. The country is rule-bound and risk-averse. It has an island mentality. We are unique, and no one can understand us. Despite its modernity, it looks to the past as a guide for the future. I was reminded of this when I went to a small town near Hiroshima last fall. I'd been invited to a concert of ancient court music. The musicians performed in full costume. They said the same costumes worn 1,200 years ago. The musicians proudly explained how they're preserving traditions that China lost long ago. And it's true, China likes to throw out the old, bring in the new. Last week, there was an international model competition in the middle-sized city of Wuxi. You see that sexy girl on the dance floor? It was sponsored by China's New Silk Road Modeling Agency. It aspires to compete with the top Western agencies, like Ford and Elite. Teenagers paraded in teeny-weeny, shiny gold bikinis. One of the judges, Alexander Wan, said the world should take a lesson from what it sees on the catwalk.
Pacing. The pacing is most important. People never understand. China is a fast-paced country. It's a 100-miles-an-hour country. So if you're not fast enough, don't come to China.
That reminded me of the Japanese art gallery owner, who told me that he wanted to be part of the action, and he says you can't find it in Tokyo. It appears, in the global arena, it's the fast-moving Yang powers that elbow their way to the center stage. For Pacific Time, I'm Jocelyn Ford in Beijing.
And coming up, casinos entice Asian Americans to the tables while community leaders worry. You're listening to Pacific Time on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Wan Ha. Last week, we reported that the American gaming industry has found that Asians and Asian Americans are its best customers. One study out of the University of California at Los Angeles showed that half of patrons at one LA casino are of Asian heritage. That's in a county where only 13% are Asian American. Those numbers trouble many in the community who fear that addiction to the gaming tables can destroy families and create financial ruin. And some studies suggest that Asian Americans may be 10 times more susceptible to problem gambling than the general population. Lenora Chu found former gambling addicts who want to change those odds.
In a bubble tea shop in the Los Angeles suburb of Roland Heights, John and Angela have come to tell their own stories of gambling addiction. As members of a 12-step program, they identify themselves only by first name. John emigrated from China nearly 3 decades ago. He was educated at one of the best universities in Asia, and once he arrived in California, he quickly settled into what looked like the American dream. He and his wife were software engineers. They raised three kids and owned a comfortable home and several rental properties. At first, Vegas was simply for vacation. Then one time on a lark, John took $700 to the blackjack table and walked away with $20,000. The next week at work, he found himself daydreaming about his next trip.
I cannot chase away my fantasy. It keeps popping up a thought that I maybe just go to Las Vegas once or twice a month, extra income. Then I start all kinds of fantasy. I think then I can buy a car, I can even buy, after a couple of years, I can buy the fancy house. And then I realize that's how he got me hooked on.
The next time he went, he won $60,000. The casinos quickly pinpointed him as a high roller. They began sending airfare vouchers and limousines to fetch him. He felt invincible. Then on one trip, John began losing, big time. He lost all the cash he brought with him and then maxed out his credit cards. The casinos then gave him a line of credit. He could show up in Vegas with nothing but an ID and have $50,000 at his disposal. But the bills started piling up at home. That's how his wife found out he had a problem.
The bill come. In the beginning, I tried to intercept all the bill, but too many. And then one day she found out and said, "What's this?" She realized I had a big problem, a gambling problem.
He didn't want to lose his family, so he pleaded with her to give him time. Meanwhile, she could not imagine tossing years of marriage down the drain. So they sold their rental properties to pay off his debts, more than $750,000. John tried to clean up his act, but he couldn't stop betting, and soon he was back in debt, even deeper than before.
So I finally agreed, I tried to divorce with my wife, because she's working, I know I don't want to make my wife and my three kids a nightmare. I think my plan at that time, 1992, I was thinking, well, I just divorce, and then I try to move to Las Vegas, thinking if I can win my money back, no, it's good. That's why I'm going to suicide there, because it's really so painful.
John says he was desperate. Thoughts of blackjack consumed him day and night. He would dream about cards and wake up in the middle of the night sweating. Eventually, he knew he couldn't do it alone. That's when he found Gamblers Anonymous, and that's how he made a friend out of Angela.
So I started to gamble just for fun, you know, play a little bit slot machine. But eventually I crossed the line.
Angela had a troubled marriage, and instead of facing her problems at home, she fled to Vegas to escape. That part was easy, since her job as a guide for Chinese tour groups took her to Vegas a few times a month. She graduated from quarters to dollar slot machines, blackjack, and later Pai Gow. But life at home got worse. Her husband lost his job, money was tight, and he threatened to kill himself if she left him.
So my thinking is I have no way out. So I might as well just blow it. I hate it, I go there, I hate it, and just like, I lost my house over gambling. I filed bankruptcy, and I divorced finally. I move out and I share with my colleague. I couldn't survive because all the credit card mixmen. And I have no way to lie to anybody, to borrow money. And I remember that there's time that I gotta buy 3 noodle soup for $1 to survive.
Over 8 years, Angela lost more than $500,000 and took out a second and third mortgage on her home. Part of the trouble was that Vegas was the only place she felt special.
What I like, I sit on a mirage table without saying anything. The waitress know me. Without asking her, she will give me 2 pack of 100 Marlboro Light, coffee, and Diet Coke. That's a great feeling. You know, you feel like you're a big shot. Eventually, you become big, you know, but...
One day, Angela saw an ad for Gamblers Anonymous near the hotel elevator. It gave a toll-free number to call, which was good, she says, because she didn't even have a quarter in her pocket. Both John and Angela relapsed after their first time through the program, and the second, and the third. But eventually, something clicked. Angela has been clean for 6 years now, and John has been clean for 14. And in 2003, they started the country's only Chinese language Gamblers Anonymous group. They meet every Tuesday night in the San Gabriel Valley, home to thousands of Asian Americans just east of LA. They start every meeting with a review of the 12 steps to recovery. Number one asks them to admit that they are powerless over gambling. Number seven requires them to ask God to remove their shortcomings. And the last step is to carry this message to other compulsive gamblers. But John and Angela know that part of the challenge is getting Asian Americans to admit their problem in the first place.
You know, we see a lot of Chinese people in casino, but we don't see much Chinese people in the GA program. We don't talk about our problem. Our pride gotta be number one. You know, we can die for pride, then admit it we have no power.
Angela acknowledges that the success rates for Gamblers Anonymous are typically only about 3% per year. But even helping one person, she says, is enough for her. It has to be, because she still dreams about winning big.
Every time I pass the casino, actually a tear in my eyes, and I sometimes gotta run, you know, it's like a monster, you know, chasing me, and it's very painful to look at the slot machine creature I love most.
John has reconciled with his wife. Angela is still leading tour groups to Vegas, but now, instead of hitting the casino floor during her free time, Angela says she'll find a Gamblers Anonymous meeting to reinforce her beliefs. After all, in Vegas, there's a GA meeting somewhere in the city every 2 hours. For Pacific Time, I'm Lenora Chu in Los Angeles.
Free Food for Millionaires is a debut novel by Minjin Lee. It's a story that looks at America's melting pot through the eyes of a Korean-American student in an Ivy League school. The story reflects on the assimilation of its protagonist, Casey Han, who is a child of immigrants. Former Pacific Time intern Larissa Joe is also a child of immigrants. She's a sophomore at Harvard and found truth in the novel.
In Minjin Lee's novel, Free Food for Millionaires, the heroine Casey Han describes how she learned to act rich by piggybacking on her Princeton friend's ritzy vacations. It reminded me of when I was accepted to Harvard. My family was invited to an informal get-together of incoming students at the home of an alumna. I stepped into her house and had three competing thoughts. One, I was undoubtedly tracking dirt onto the lush carpeting. Two, I was underdressed. And three, boy, was this a whole new ballgame. At college, there were kids my age who dressed like they were high-powered attorneys. Champagne and strawberries were served at receptions. At cheese and wine schmooze fests, I fortified myself with grapes that surrounded the Gruyere and cheddar. I really don't like cheese. In the novel, Casey goes home to blue-collar New Jersey suburbia for her summer vacations. I go home to the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm back in a world of parents in hot pursuit of getting the best for their kids. Summer camp? What's she doing? Where? How much? And often, when parents find out, wow, Harvard? So much for small talk at the Chinese supermarket. It's just embarrassingly obvious that the people of my community are famished for success. And in an indirect way, I'm reminded to be proud of all those brash, bold Asian parents I know, often clamoring ungracefully and unsubtly to get the best for their kids. Just as we're full to the point of being nauseous every time we go to the Asian buffet for dinner, my parents didn't come all the way from China just so we could be only kind of successful. And if success means donning a pencil skirt and stilettos and learning to eat cheese smeared on tiny water crackers, it's just as well, I guess. I have to come out from behind my books eventually.
Larissa Joe is a sophomore at Harvard. And here's what else is making news in Asia and Asian America. Who says you can't be smart and fashionable? Harvard University may not be known for graduating fashionistas, but it's going to root for them. Fashion designers of Asian heritage around the world are coming to a student-organized fashion show next month at Harvard. The show aims to increase media awareness of Asian designers and help them build stronger relationships with design houses. And North Korea laid out a timetable to shut down all of its nuclear facilities by the end of the year. Once its nuclear facilities are disarmed, North Korea will receive close to 1 million metric tons of fuel oil. The Bush administration says the agreement is a model to deal with Iran and its nuclear activities. And South Korea's president met with North Korea's Kim Jong-il this week to discuss a peace settlement and economic development. It's only the second time in 50 years that leaders from the Koreas have met. It's time for us to say goodbye. Please join us next week. It'll be the last edition of Pacific Time. Our theme music was composed by Anthony Brown with the Asian American Orchestra. Visit us on the web at kqed.org/pacific time. Got a story idea or a comment on something you heard here? Email us, pacifictime@kqed.org. Our staff includes Nina Thorson, Nguyen Quyduc, Seal Muller, Susie Racho, Mina Kim, Helen Lee, Michelle Chang, Michelle Lay, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Juan Ha. Thanks for tuning in.
Funds for the production of Pacific Time are provided by the Freeman Foundation, Matthews International Capital Management, a San Francisco-based advisor investing in the future of Asia since 1994, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, and the KQED Campaign for the Future Program Venture Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.